Chapter 19. Melba. The injustice of it shrieked in the back of her skull. It wouldn't let her sleep. It had come so close to working. So much of it had worked. But then Holden dove into the ring, and something had saved him, and Melba felt a huge, invisible fist drive itself into her gut. And it was still there. She'd watched the whole thing unfold in her quarters, sitting cross-legged on her crash couch, her hand terminal seeking information from any feed. The network had been so swamped with other people doing the same thing, her own signal wouldn't stand out. No one would wonder why she was watching when everyone else was doing the same. When the OPA had opened fire, she'd heard the Earth forces bracing for a wave of sabotage explosions that never came. The anger at Holden, the condemnations and recriminations had been pouring like cool water on a burn. Her team had been called up on an emergency run to the Sung-Un, repairing the damage she'd done, but she'd checked in whenever there was a free moment. When Mars had turned its targeting lasers on the Rocinante, guiding the missile to him, she'd laughed out loud. Holden had stopped her outgoing message, but at the expense of killing his whole communications array. There was no way he could send out a retraction in time. When he'd passed through the ring, she'd been in three conversations simultaneously and watching an electrical meter for dangerous fluctuations. She didn't find out until they were being rotated back to the Cerisier that Holden hadn't died, that he wasn't going to. The missile had been stopped, and the enemy had been spared. Back on her ship, she'd gone straight to her bunk, curled up on the crash couch and tried not to panic. Her brain felt like it had come untied. Her thoughts ran in random directions. If the Martians had just launched a few missiles of their own instead of waiting for the OPAs to do the job, Holden would be dead. If the Rocinante had been a few thousand kilometers closer to the behemoth when it fired, Holden would be dead. The gimbling under her couch hushed back and forth in the last of the deceleration burn, and she realized she was shaking her body, banging her back against the gel. If the thing that made the protomolecule, the nameless, evil thing that was hunched in the abyssal black on the other side of the ring, hadn't changed the laws of physics, Holden would be dead. Holden was alive. She'd always known that the destruction of James Holden was a fragile thing. Discrepancies would be there if anyone looked closely. She couldn't match her announcement to the exact burn that the Rocinante would be on when she sprang her trap. There would be artifacts in the video that a sufficiently close analysis would detect. By the time that happened, though, it would have been too late. The story of James Holden would have been set. New evidence could be dismissed as crackpots and conspiracy theorists, but it required that Holden and his crew be dead. It was something she'd always heard her father say. If the other man's dead, the judge only has one story to follow. When he put his communication array back together, the investigation would begin. She'd be caught. They'd find out it was her. And the thought had the copper taste of fear. They'd find Wren. They'd know she killed him. Her father would know. Word would reach him in his cell that she had beaten Wren to death, and that would be worse than anything. Not that she'd done it, Melba thought. That she'd been caught doing it. The sound came from her door. Three hard thumps, and she screamed despite herself. Her heart was racing, the blood tapping at the inside of her throat, banging at her ribs. "Miss Cole?" Soledad's voice came. "You in there? I need to talk if you've..." Hearing fear in someone else's voice felt like vertigo. Melba got to her feet. Either the pilot was repositioning the ship, or she was just unsteady. She couldn't tell which. She looked in her mirror, and the woman looking out could almost have been a normal person woken from a deep sleep. "Just a minute," she said, running her fingers through her hair, pressing the dark locks against her scalp. Her face felt clammy. Nothing to be done. She opened the door. Soledad stood in the thin, cramped corridor. The muscles in her jaw worked like she was chewing something. Her wide eyes skittered over Melba, away and back, away and back. "I'm sorry, Miss Coe, but I can't do it. I can't go there. They can fire me, but I can't go." Melba reached out and put her hand on the woman's arm. The touch seemed to startle them both. "All right," she said. "It'll be all right. Where can't you go?" The ship shifted. That one wasn't her imagination, because Sole moved too. "The prince," she said. I don't want to volunteer." "Volunteer for what?" Melba asked. She felt like she was coaxing the girl back from some sort of mental break. There was enough self-awareness left in her to appreciate the irony. "Didn't you get the message? It's from the contract supervisor." Melba looked back over her shoulder. Her hand terminal was on the crash couch, a green and red band on the screen showing that there was a priority message waiting. She raised a finger, keeping Soledad out of the room and away from the locker, and grabbed the terminal. The message had come through 10 hours before, marked urgent and must reply. Melba wondered how long she'd been lying on her couch, lost in her panic fugue. She thumbed the message accept. A stream of tight legal script poured onto the screen, brash as a shout. "Danis General Contracting, owners and operators of half the civilian support craft in the fleet, including the Cerisier, was invoking the exceptional actions clause of the standard contract. Each functional team would choose a designated volunteer for temporary duty on the UNN Thomas Prince. The remuneration would remain at the standard level until completion of the contract, when any hazard bonuses or exemptions would be assessed." Melba had to read the words 3 times to understand them. "I can't go in there," Soledad was saying, somewhere away to her left. The voice had taken on an irritating whine. "My father, I told you about him. You understand, your sister was there too. You have to tell Bob or Stanley to do it, I can't." They were going after Holden. They were going through the ring after Holden. Her panic didn't fall away so much as click into focus. "None of you are going," Melba said. "This one's mine." The official transfer was the easiest thing she'd done since she came aboard. She sent a message to the contracts officer with her ID number and a short message saying that she'd accept transfer to the Prince. 2 minutes later, she had her orders. 3 hours to finish her affairs on the Cerisier, then into the transport, and gone. It was intended, she knew, as a time to meet with her team, make the transition easy. She had other fish to fry. Filling a locker with industrial sealant was one thing. The foam was made to apply quickly and remain malleable for a few seconds before the yellow mush dimmed to gold and set. The excess could be cut away with a sharp knife for the next hour. After that, nothing would move it except the right kind of solvent, and even that was an ugly, arduous process. But leaving the body where it could be found wasn't an option. Someone would be assigned to her bunk, and they'd want to use the locker. Besides which, leaving Wren behind seemed somehow wrong. And so, with 2.5 hours before she left the ship, Melba took a pair of shoulder-length latex gloves, 3 cans of solvent, a roll of absorbent towels, and a vacuum-rated large personal tool case into her room, and locked the door behind her. The locker door didn't want to open at first, fixed in place by a drop of sealant she hadn't noticed, but a few sprays of solvent degraded it until she could pull it open with her fingers. The sealant was a single, rough-textured face of gold, like a cliff made small. She opened the tool case, took a deep breath, and faced the grave. "I'm sorry about this," she said. "I'm really, really sorry." At first, the solvent spray didn't seem to do anything beyond a sharp smell, but then the sealant began ticking, like 1,000 insects walking over stone. Gouges and crevices formed in the sealant wall, then a small runnel of slime. She rolled up a few of the towels, setting them on the floor to catch the flow. Wren's knee was the first part to appear, the round cap of the bone and death-blackened skin emerging from the melting foam like a fossil. The fabric of his uniform was soaked with fluid rot. The smell hit her, but it wasn't as bad as she'd expected. She'd imagined herself retching and weeping, but it was gentler than that. When she took his legs to draw him out, they fell away from his pelvis. So she cut the trousers, wrapped the legs in towels, and put them in the toolbox. Her mind was quiet and still, like an archaeologist pulling the dead of centuries before out into the light. Here was his spine. This was the vile slush where the hydrochloric acid in his gut, no longer held in check by the mechanisms of life, had digested his stomach, his liver, his intestines. She drew out his head last, the bright red hair darkened and flecked with matter like an overused kitchen mop. She lifted the bones into the toolbox, packed them with the gore and corruption-soaked towels, then closed his new coffin, triggered the seal, and set the lock combination. She had 40 minutes left. She spent another 10 minutes cleaning out the locker where Wren had spent his death, then stripped off the gloves and threw them in the recycler. She bathed, trying to scrub off the stink, and noticed distantly that she was sobbing. She ignored the fact, and by the time she'd changed into her new uniform, the crying seemed to have stopped. She picked up the last of her things, threw them in a pack, put her still wet hair in a ponytail, and hauled Wren to the loading bay where the other supplies would be taken across to the prince. It didn't allow her time to say her goodbyes to Soledad or Stani or Bob. She was sorry for that, but it was a burden she could bear. There were about 30 of them, all told. Men and women she'd seen around the ship, heard their names once or twice, nodded to in the galley or on the exercise machines. Once they reached the prince, they were all brought into a small, white conference room with benches that bolted to the floor like pews. They were already under thrust, already moving for the ring and whatever was on the other side. While the overly enthusiastic yeoman prattled on about the Thomas Prince, she glanced at the faces around her. An old man with a scruffy white beard and ice-blue eyes, a stocky blonde woman who was probably younger than she was, with poorly applied eyeliner and a grim look about the jowls. They'd all come here of their own free will. Or free will is bounded by the terms of their work contracts. They were all going through the ring, into the mouth of whatever was on the other side. She wondered what would motivate them to do it. What kinds of secrets they'd hidden in their tool chests. "You will need to keep your identification cards with you at all times," the yeoman was saying, holding up a white plastic card on a lanyard. "Not only are these the keys to get into your quarters, they'll also get you food in the civilian commissary, and they'll let you know if you're where you're supposed to be." The blonde woman turned toward Melba and glared. Melba looked away, blushing. She hadn't intended to stare. "Never be rude unintentionally," her father had always said. The yeoman's white card turned a deep, bloody red. "If you see this," he said, "it means you're in a restricted area and need to leave immediately. Don't worry too much. She's a big ship, and we all get a little turned around sometimes. I got buzzed 4 times the first week I was here. No one's going to get bent out of shape over an honest mistake, but security will be following up on them, so be prepared." Melba looked at her own white card. It had her name, a picture of her unsmiling face. The yeoman was talking about how much they were appreciated, and how their service was an honor to the ship and to themselves. All in this together, one big team. The first stirring of hatred for the man shifted in her gut, and she tried to distract herself. She didn't know what she'd do once they were all on the other side, but she had to find Holden. She had to destroy him. The sound man, too. Anything that led back to her had to be destroyed or discredited. She wondered if there was a way to get a fake card, or one that belonged to someone with a lot more clearance than Melba Coe would have. Maybe one that could check out a shuttle. She'd need to look into it. She was improvising now, and getting the best tool she could manage would be critical. Around her, people began standing up. From the bored looks and the quiet, she figured they were beginning the walking tour. She'd been through the Thomas Prince before. She was already familiar with the high ceilings and wide corridors where three people could walk abreast. She might not know where everything was, but she could fake it. She fell in line with the others. "In case of emergency, all you have to do is get back to your quarters and strap in," the yeoman said, walking backwards so that he could keep lecturing them while they all moved, bumping against each other like cattle. Someone behind her made a soft, mooing sound, and someone else chuckled. The joke had gone out to the darkness of space, even where cows hadn't. "Now, through here is the civilian commissary," the yeoman said as they passed through a pair of sliding steel doors. "Those of you who were working here before might be used to getting your food and coffee from the officer's mess, but now that we're on a military operation, this is going to be the place to go." The civilian commissary was a low, gray box of a room with tables and chairs bolted to the floor, and a dozen people of all ages and dress sat scattered around. A thin man with improbably pale hair leaned against a crash-padded wall, drinking something from a bulb. Two older men in black robes and clerical collars sat huddled together like the unpopular kids at a cafeteria. Melba was already beginning to turn inward again, ignoring them all, when something caught her. A familiar voice. 20 feet away, Tilly Fagan leaned in toward an older man who looked like he was struggling between annoyance and flirtation. Her hair was up, and her laughter caustic in a way that recalled long, uncomfortable dinner parties with both of their families. Melba felt a sudden atavistic shame at being so underdressed. For a sickening moment, her false self slipped away, and she was Clarissa again. Forcing herself to move slowly, calmly, she drifted to the back of the crowd, making herself as small and difficult to notice as she could. Tilly glanced over at the nattering yeoman and his herd of technicians with undisguised annoyance, but didn't notice Melba. Not this time. The yeoman led them all back out of the commissary, down the long hallway to their new quarters. Melba took her ponytail down and brushed her hair in close around her face. She'd known, of course, that the prince had the delegation from Earth, but she'd discounted them. Now she wondered how many other people here knew Clarissa Mao. She had the horrible image of turning a corner and seeing Mika Kraus or Stephen Comer. She could see their eyes going wide with surprise, and she wondered whether she could bring herself to kill them, too. If she couldn't, the brig and the news feeds and a prison cell like her father's would follow. The yeoman was talking about their quarters, assigning them out one by one to all the volunteer technicians. They were tiny, but the need for each person to have a crash couch in case of emergency meant they wouldn't be hot bunking. She could stay in there, bribe one of the others to bring her food. Except, holed up like a rat, tracking and killing Holden became exponentially more difficult. There had to be a way. The yeoman called her name, and she realized it wasn't the first time. "Here," she said, "sorry." She scuttled into her room, the door recognizing her white card and unlocking for her, then closing when she was inside. She stood for a long moment, scratching her arm. The room was bright and clean, and as unlike the Cerisier as Nepal was from Colombia. "You came to improvise," she said, and her voice sounded like it came from someone else. "Well, here you are. Start improvising."